Before we start today, I'd like you to listen to a few minutes of an interview that I have just done with a pair of Close Encounter witnesses who had experiences continuously with the visitors over an 11-day period back in 1966. You cannot get this anywhere else. There is nowhere else that a researcher who is also a Close Encounter witness is doing interviews like this, because there's no one else doing them. I need you to subscribe to unknowncountry.com, stop listening to the free section, and start listening to the subscriber section, and take advantage of everything that is there. It is incredibly rich, and it's there for you. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and click on the subscribe tab. Listen to this excerpt.
We figured that the alien beaming device wasn't working, and they actually came to the door, and they were telling us telepathically to open the door.
Yeah, that was the terrible night. I don't know. We've read a lot about stuff later on, trying to figure out what happened, and it looks like, you know, everybody's saying they can walk through walls and stuff, but for us, they told Mary to go open the door.
To listen to more, go to unknowncountry.com, where you will find, in addition to this interview, hundreds of other interviews from all different directions, all kinds of subjects, including numerous contactee interviews, my own hypnosis sessions, the audio books of Communion, Majestic, The Secret School, and others, a section of meditations renowned for their power and usefulness, and so much more. So go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe right now.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Over Christmas, we talked to two prominent scientists, Dr. Edward Bell Bruno and Deep Prasad, who had close encounter experiences that profoundly influenced their lives, and especially in Dr. Bell Bruno's case, his career for the better. Now, today, we're going to be talking to two UFO investigators who have had the same sorts of experiences and have written a book about it called, appropriately enough, Confession: Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed. So we're in a situation now where UFO investigators, scientists, and in some cases some academics are having close encounter experiences, or more accurately, admitting this. This radio program and Unknown Country and everything I do has a single aim. It is to clarify contact, not necessarily to facilitate it, but to clarify it and bring it forward as part of normal human experience. And it is extraordinary, but it is so commonplace that it is also normal. So in that light, I would like to welcome Robert Hastings and Dr. Bob Jacobs to this radio program. UFO and nukes researcher Robert Hastings and military whistleblower Bob Jacobs are going to talk about their status as experiencers, long hidden, because after all, they are basic nuts and bolts researchers interested in the feet on the ground and what they came out of, not necessarily so much in this spiritual journey, in the spiritual exploration that some of us are on. Now, let me begin by introducing both of you and welcoming you to the show, and start by asking you, Bob, what brought you into the UFO experience in the first place?
Robert Hastings did.
Okay, but let's go a little deeper than that. It must have been more than Robert Hastings.
I'll tell you how Robert and I met, and that will help understand how this came about. Robert was doing a film about his book called UFOs and Nukes. And I had a TV station at my university in Peoria, Illinois, and we brought some of his guests in to interview them in my station so we could get some nice high-quality video. We spent, I think, 2 or 3 days doing those interviews, and at the end of the final day, Robert came into my office, and we were sitting chatting about how nice a time we'd had. And Robert said, and he and I had known each other for several years up to this point, never talked about what our topic is today. We were sitting there, and suddenly he reached over and closed the door to my office, and he said, Bob, I have to tell you something. I'm going to confess something that I haven't told anybody else. He said, I'm an abductee, and there's a triple-digit thingy that goes on. Every time I have an experience, I wake up, and there's a triple-digit on my clock. In his case, it was 444. Without thinking, I said, well, for me, it's 333.
That's amazing.
We immediately went, oh, my God, we're having similar experiences.
And at this point, you're both UFO researchers. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, let's roll back a little bit, Bob, and get into what brought you into the UFO field in the first place.
I was in the U.S. Air Force in the 60s, and I was officer in charge of photo optical instrumentation at Vandenberg Air Force Base. I had a 134-member section. And our job was to photograph on high-speed instrumentation photography every single launch of every single missile down the Western Test Range. Our footage was used by engineers at Boeing and Lockheed and other places to evaluate what was going on with those missiles, which we then dubbed inter-county ballistic missiles because many of them blew up before they even got off the pad. So one day I was called into the office of a major mansman in the 1st Strategic Air Command building. They wondered if I knew anything about Northern California, Big Sur in particular. And I said, well, I used to be a hippie. As such, I used to drive my, actually, I was a beatnik then. I drove my MG up to Big Sur to have coffee at Nepenthe and talk to all the beat poets and so forth. So, yes, I knew something about Big Sur. If you know about the California coastline, it's kind of lumpy. And Monterey Bay and San Francisco Bay are up there. And then there's a lump that sticks out into the ocean called Big Sur. From Big Sur, you can look back down toward Vandenberg, and you're looking actually back southeast where the missiles take off. So from a peak at Big Sur, in fact, it was Anderson Peak, we could see the missiles take off from Vandenberg and go downrange, and we could photograph from the side all three stages of powered flight, which is what the engineers wanted. So I was dispatched up to Big Sur to find a place where we could put our tracking mounts, and I went up there for the first of probably dozens of such trips up there. I found a nice flat spot up near Anderson Peak where we could put a tracking mount and we photographed some missiles taking off, and the engineers were ecstatic. Then Major Mansman called me into his office again. He said, I'm going to send something up to you, Big Sir, Bob. I want you to get your crew up there with your tracking stuff, and we're going to send something out to you from Cape Canaveral. And what they sent out was called the BU Telescope. It was invented by Dr. Walter Manning at Boston University, and it was a 2,500-inch catadioptric telescope mounted on an 18-wheel truck. And they flew it out to California. We dragged it up a Forest Service road to our site on Anderson Peak, and they wanted to use this extremely high-powered telescope to photograph all three stages of powered flight. Well, 2,500-inch telescope is enormous when you consider the normal lens on a 35-millimeter camera is 50 millimeters, or 2 inches. So with this huge telescope, which, by the way, Dr. Manning and I had some discussions about it while we were chatting and talking about it, he said that he had been using this telescope back at Cape Canaveral to point straight up into the sky and photograph living cells, intelligent entities in our atmosphere. I, of course, chuckled at this and went on with my business. I did not believe in UFOs. I had no experience with UFOs. I grew up with Ray Bradbury. He was my godfather, the great science fiction writer. He didn't believe in UFOs either. And so I was blissfully unaware that there were other things flying around in our atmosphere until this happened. On a day in September of 1964, we were alerted by the base that they were about to launch an Atlas missile, and it had a dummy atomic warhead on top. It was part of an experiment designed to test our defenses against Russia's anti-missile missiles.
Right, I got it.
Okay, so here we were. It was early morning. There was a fog bank in on the ocean, and suddenly popped out of the fog bank from Vandenberg, 137 miles distant, an Atlas rocket. Our catadioptric telescope locked onto it, with what I believe is radar tracking. It locked onto it, and off it went. We photographed all three stages of powered flight, and it went off and disappeared into the nothingness. We were all thrilled. We got shot. I took the film back down to Vandenberg and had it processed. And a day or two later, Major Mansman called me into his office. I walked into the office, and there was Major Mansman. There was a 16-millimeter projector sitting on a table and two guys in gray suits. And they were both looking at me. Major Mansman said, "Lieutenant, sit down, and I want you to look at something." I said, "Okay." So he turned on the projector, and there was the most astonishing thing I'd ever seen in my life. The three rocket nozzles of the Atlas missile were filling the frame from 137 miles away. And that rocket took off elegantly, beautifully, sailed off into near space. We got all three stages of powered flight. They fell away. And there we had the nose cone flying along, and it opened, and a sea of chaff, essentially aluminum foil strips, were displayed in front of it. Then that stuff was all flying along at about 8,000 miles an hour, and the dummy warhead, mind you, I say dummy, it wasn't a real nuclear warhead, but it was an exact replica of one. It had a small rocket motor on it, and it ejected into an orbit, suborbit slightly above the chaff. Now, all this stuff is flying along, and we couldn't see this from Big Sur because it was too far away, but the telescope had picked it up. And all these objects were flying along, and suddenly, on the left-hand side of the screen, something flew into the frame, going the same way that our package was going. It flew in. It shot a beam of light at the dummy warhead. It rotated up to the top of the dummy warhead, shot another beam of light at it, rotated around to the front of the warhead. Mind you, this is all going 8,000 miles an hour. Shot another beam of light, rotated down to the bottom, shot another beam of light at the dummy warhead, and flew back out of the frame the same way it had come in. The dummy warhead tumbled out of the sky. The object that we saw was a flying saucer, a circular object with a ping pong ball on top of it, firing these beams of light. And here's the exciting news. I was just yesterday looking at this naval footage that ATIP has released.
Right.
And in the center of the screen of one of those shots was the exact same object that I saw. It's been photographed now by the Navy, the same saucer-shaped thing. It's exactly what I saw. Major Mansman got to look at it under high magnification and described it in much better detail. The only difference between what I saw and what the Navy has on its video here is that the Navy's film is in negative. Our film was positive, so the object looked white, and the Navy's film looks black, but it's exactly the same shape. Well, the lights came on. Major Mansman said, "Were you guys screwing around up there?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Then what was that?" I said, "Well, looks to me like we got a UFO." He pointed his finger at me and said, "You are never to say that again. You are never to speak of this again." The two guys in gray suits were staring at me. Major Mansman said, "As far as you're concerned, Lieutenant, this never happened." And he walked me to the door. And at the door, as I was going out, he said, "Sotto voce," so that the guys in gray suits didn't hear. He said, "If you are ever in the future cornered, tortured, and you have to say that you saw something, just tell him it was laser strikes." And he shut the door and I walked off. And for 17 years, I shut my mouth.
Well, free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break here. And when we get back, we're going to find out what happened after 17 years for him to finally break his silence. As an unknowncountry.com subscriber, you can hear extraordinary interviews such as this interview that Linda Howe did with Gary McKinnon. Remember him? He was the supposed hacker who got into a secret area of NASA's websites and exposed all kinds of extraordinary information about space forces and so forth. And we thought that since this Space Force is now going public, it might be worth your while to listen to an interview like this done years ago with a man who saw this documentation himself. There was a big fight to deport him from England to the United States. He eventually stayed in England, and his story has sort of disappeared, but not from unknowncountry.com. We don't forget this stuff. Listen up to this sample, and then think seriously about what you're missing by not subscribing to this website. There follows a truly extraordinary interview between Linda Moulton Howe and Gary McKinnon, one of the few. Gary McKinnon was the young Britisher who hacked into NASA's computer system and found all kinds of very unusual material about space forces and all sorts of things. Well, now in 2020, the Space Force is going public. So was it really there all along? One of the few places you can hear an interview like this is on unknowncountry.com. This is one of the most extraordinary places in the world, and you really should get into it. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. You can listen to Gary McKinnon speaking very frankly about what he found, and there is so much more on this website. It is literally a treasure trove. Go to unknowncountry.com right now, click on the subscribe tab, and get started. There is real wonder waiting for you. Did you know that there is a whole area of our subscriber section on unknowncountry.com devoted exclusively to meditations? I have created numerous meditations which are all collected there. As an example, one of them, called Quantum Meditation, is about how to meditate when the mind is in an unfocused state that is thought of as superposition, where something is everywhere at once, in effect, part of all reality. There's a lot of powerful stuff in our meditation section. Do check it out. And if you're not a subscriber, well, subscribe today and start to explore. This is worthwhile. It's valuable. So do it now. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab, subscribe, and dig in. Robert Hastings and Dr. Bob Jacobs' Confession, Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed. Okay, Bob, what happened next? Did you just drop it or what?
As I got back to my office, I realized that something incredible had just happened to me. Flying saucers were real. These things were flying around in our skies, not only flying around, but they were interfering with our dummy nuclear warhead test. Imagine how difficult it was for me, Whitley, to keep my mouth shut for all those years and not say anything to my wife, my colleagues, anybody I knew. I just had to swallow that until one day I was doing I used to be a disc jockey in Northern California, and I was doing a late night talk show, and the topic of UFOs came up, and I thought, what the heck, I'm going to tell my story. And I did. And then a couple of years went by, and I found myself teaching college in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And I, you know, the teachers don't make a whole lot of money. So during the summer, I decided I'd write an article about this UFO story because it kept haunting me. I kept thinking about it and concerning myself about it. I thought, I need to tell somebody about this. So I wrote an article, and I passed it around to several magazines. Nobody wanted it except the National Enquirer. Well, they published it, but their language is so revolting that it was probably ridiculed, but at least I got it out there. Then I was contacted by Walt Andrews at MUFON, and my friend who worked for Tester Corporation, John Andrews. They said, Bob, write this up in academic form, and they published it in MUFON magazine. And I can't say what hit the fan, but something hit the fan. I started getting telephone calls late at night, saying, screaming at me, calling me names, and saying that, quote, I'm saying with somebody, you're going down, two words started with M and F. You were going down, MF, and they click off. They were, these things went on for weeks. One night, my wife and I had come home from the movies, and the phone rang as we came in the door, and a voice said, fireworks in your mailbox at night. Oh, what a beautiful sight. And at that moment, my rural mailbox blew up, and they said, you're going down.
Huh. I gather you had not signed a security clearance or confidentiality order or anything like that.
No, because curiously enough, and I guess wonderfully enough in the long run, is Major Manson never said this is classified top secret. He said it didn't happen.
That's right. So you weren't in any violation of the law at all when you talked about it.
It finally occurred to me that I could not violate a security clearance because they didn't tell me it was classified. The idiot.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, you still don't know that. No one's ever told you it was classified.
Well, if I've heard now it's still classified. I think Robert Hastings knows that.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. But the thing is, well, like for example, my uncle Mickey, Edward Streber, and General Exon, who were close friends, were involved in the Roswell incident. But they did have security clearances in their lives, as far as I know. They never violated those clearances. When they talked to me about the incident, they told me that they were not violating the law doing that. So for whatever reason, someone had said to them, talk to him about this. But, you know, that's a very serious business. And when I hear these stories of these whistleblowers who are supposedly violating the law, I always wonder how real that is, because you know, in my experience, those laws are really taken seriously. But you slipped under the radar here.
I guess I did.
Yeah,
because all those years, it was 17 years between the incident and my writing about it, and all during that time, I felt haunted by this information I had. I had seen this.
Well, of course.
I kept seeing people being ridiculed for reporting UFOs and so on and so forth. I started doing some research, and I in fact read your book Communion, which was the first book I read where I went, gee, this abduction thing is obviously real, because this Whitley Strieber guy has certainly written it up in a believable fashion.
Well, thank you. I had plenty of trouble with that one, believe me. Still do to this day. But we're going to return later in the show to the question of the abductions and why the two of you ended up involved in this, in being abducted at all, and also what you think is going on. Because, folks, you know, we have different levels of this. Sometimes we have people on the show who have a very spiritual approach. Now we're having on the show people who have less so. I would say that Ed Belbruno was sort of a mixed picture. Deep Prasad was strictly nuts and bolts. He saw these beings walking. You guys may not know this story. This is such a great story. He is an artificial intelligence expert, and at 9:30 one morning, he looks up, and there are some little grays just walking around in his office. Mm-hmm. And it came out of nowhere. It wasn't even part of his life in any way whatsoever. And, you know, so they're definitely on the move. Let's put it that way. They're coming. Now, I want to, though, return to these calls and what happened to you. Who do you think was doing this? It's sort of childish, kind of ominous threats, but folks, Free Dreamlanders, before we do that, listen up and please subscribe, because if you do that, then you won't have to listen up anymore. We'll be right back.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka says, enter this risky new world and leave empowered. New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, riveting, I couldn't put it down. Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. and as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Robert Hastings and Dr. Bob Jacobs. Their new book, Confession, Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed, two longtime and highly respected UFO people in the UFO field, basically nuts and bolts investigators, are now talking about their own close encounters. And in fact, in the life of Robert Hastings, a lifetime of close encounters, which he's just recently begun to fully understand, or really to fully be aware of, I should say. I don't think if anybody understands this, please call me. I'd love to know that answer. In any case, before we left the air, Bob, I was asking you to expand a little bit on the threats that started to come when you went public, because here these people were, we all know that this is a very high level of secrecy involved in this. I mean, just last week, the United States Navy announced that it did have more video of those things that are called the Tic Tacs, but that it wouldn't release it because releasing it would mean an extreme threat to national security. And folks, there's an article on Unknown Country about this, and they've also got a journal entry about it, because the military doesn't say a thing like that lightly. They might have said a threat to national security, but this is a very profound threat in their opinion. Now, who do you think was doing this to you, Bob?
I'm dead certain that those two guys in Major Mansman's office were CIA. Sonny Mansman kind of agreed to that at some point later on in his life. And they, in fact, that when that film was completed, those two guys in gray suits cut off the part that had the UFO in it, gave the rest of the reel back to Major Mansman and said, "Now, we don't need to remind you about the security, the importance of a security breach, do you?" And he said, "No, sir." And they walked off with the film, and as far as I know, no one has ever seen it since. That, of course, has released it.
Well, there's got to be a whole lot of extraordinary film in hiding.
Now, I'm certain that's true.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But you never found out. You never had any sense. Did you ever see anybody like the mailbox explosion, anything?
Once my article went out to the MUFON Journal, that's when these experiences began. I started getting this telephone call. I'd be driving along, and I'd sort of noticed that there was somebody maybe following my vehicle. But it was mainly these telephone calls, and they didn't stop until I wrote my second article, and I think it was after Phil Klass or somebody had taken off at me, and I was teaching at the University of Maine, and Phil Klass, may his soul be in hell forever, wrote a letter to my chairman there saying that I was a fraud, that I was making up a cock and bull story, that I was teaching journalism, and how could they let anybody who prevaricated and made up stories teach at the university, and it cost me my job. I'm almost positive that Phil Klass was a CIA operative.
I know a lot about how he worked out, how he worked. He was the editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine, and right, traded scoops for about Air Force aerospace activities in return for doing this. I knew him well enough to know he didn't believe a word of anything he said. He once said to me, "Whitley, you should," because I come from an Air Force background, and he said, "You should not be doing this. You know, you should have more respect for your country's needs." So, that was his mental framework.
Yeah, I have respect for my country's needs, but guys like Phil Klass.
Me too. That's why I'm doing this.
Yeah, and I admire you for doing this, Will. I'm a fan of yours. I think this is important information, and Robert and I have talked about why we wrote this book. And one of the reasons that I think both he and he can speak for himself, but I think one of the reasons is that we wanted to come out with this information. Robert is a very well-respected researcher.
Yes.
And he was concerned about his reputation because he knew that when we came out with this, people were going to start taking shots at us. And before the book was even out, James Oberg took a shot at us.
And, of course, why would he do that? I guess the reason is the book is credible.
I certainly believe it's credible because it's the absolute truth. Robert and I are both truth tellers.
Yeah,
and
there's a little question about it. You talk about the Peter Jennings, and Robert, if you could address this, since this is in your part of the book, the Peter Jennings show that went on about UFOs and what they did to Bud Hopkins. And if what's interesting here is that program that appeared on ABC was relatively credible when it looked at UFOs, but not abductions. Robert, could you talk about that a little bit and give an idea of why that would be, that they would kind of draw the line there?
I believe this was in 2005. It was called UFOs, Seeing is Believing. It was hosted by Peter Jennings, well-respected news person. And as you said, the majority of the program was very factual, very objective, treated the subject seriously, examined some cases, including one involving nuclear weapons, an incident up at Minot Air Force Base in 1968 where a UFO flew near some missile silos and then subsequently played tag with a B-52 bomber in the area. And all of that was treated very straightforward in the program. However, then they switched gears and started talking about abductions and featured the work of Bud Hopkins, well-known researcher on abductions, if not the pioneer. And it was clear by the way they presented the material, they were only going to offer information that supported a skeptical viewpoint. They totally ignored research data that indicated that something anomalous was indeed occurring. For example, the way that the material was framed by ABC, it seemed as if anyone who had an abduction had it in bed at night, and they therefore threw up the theory of sleep paralysis and explained away 100% of abduction incidents as sleep paralysis related. What Bud Hopkins, in a written rebuttal to that program, noted was that the majority of abduction cases actually take place at other times than sleep. People are driving a car. People are out walking. People are doing other physical activities. And therefore, in no way, shape, or form could sleep paralysis be a viable explanation. Well, all of that data was swept under the rug. Bud Hopkins also noted the fact that other researchers, Dr. David Jacobs, who's a retired professor who's studied abductions extensively, as well as Dr. John Mack of Harvard Medical School, who also has studied abductions extensively,
right,
have both said that, sleep paralysis may account for a very small percentage of so-called abduction reports where people are seeing hallucinatory type of images in their heads, but nothing's really in the room with them. But both of these professors said that when you look at the particulars of most abduction cases, you are dealing with people doing things at the time other than sleeping or even being in bed.
And yet, it's I think of it as it couldn't possibly be true syndrome, because I see it. I work a lot with scientists and academics and, to some extent, journalists who literally can't handle the idea that this could be coming into people's bedrooms and into their lives, that it's not simply something that we see in the sky. And yet, you have to ask the question, why would they be here at all if it wasn't for us? If they're not interested in us, then what's our problem? Why aren't we interesting to them? That would be my question. Obviously, they are interested in us. They're also, though, and I would like both of you to address this issue in turn. And I think the way to do this is to start with Robert and then go to Bob. And this is the something that I sort of realized when I was working on my new book, A New World, which is that this kind of it lived in the human experience for generations, thousands of years probably. And we interpreted it in different ways, many different ways over that time. But then after World War II, and in particular, after the atomic bombs began to be used, suddenly it ramps up massively. And there are all kinds of UFO sightings all over the world, all kinds of extraordinary things are happening. And we find ourselves confronting this very powerful and not necessarily particularly pleasant unknown. Now, how do you respond to the idea that something about what we were doing, something that seemed maybe too self-destructive, has caused this to happen?
The essence of my work over 40 years now has been to investigate UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites, and both on my website, UFOHastings.com, and in a film I made on the UFO nukes connection, and in my 600-page book, UFOs and Nukes, I present just an overwhelming body of information from the 170 U.S. military veterans that I've interviewed who were on site when these events were occurring, describing disc-shaped craft or triangular-shaped craft hovering over nuclear missile sites, at which point, in many cases, the missiles malfunction. There are a number of documents that corroborate what these gentlemen said. So the UFO nuclear weapons link is well established. It goes back to at least January of 1945, even before the bombs were dropped on Japan, the atomic bombs in World War II. I've interviewed a retired Navy pilot named Bud Clem, who was called on at one point in January to chase one of these objects that was hovering over the Hanford nuclear weapons site. It was a plutonium processing facility in Washington State. And not only on that occasion, but two other occasions in January of 1945, and there are Army documents declassified that confirm this occurred, these objects were tracked on radar, military interceptors by the Navy, who were nearby at this facility, attempted to intercept them unsuccessfully, and they raced away at a high rate of speed. Now, not a lot of people, in terms of the general population, know anything about that, or indeed any of these other nuclear weapons-related cases. But they are a matter of record now. They're well-documented. When I held a press conference in 2010 in Washington, seven of these retired Air Force veterans, whom I've interviewed over the years, went on the record, worldwide news coverage, CNN streamed this event live, and discussed these classified incidents whereby they were at either missile sites or other nuclear weapons-related facilities when UFOs appeared and in some cases actually tampered with the missiles. So it is a matter of fact. It's not a matter of conjecture or speculation, but documented fact that UFO activity has occurred at nuclear weapon sites, which, as you've said, is just the nuclear era has existed for 70 years now, and it seems like UFO sightings and other incidents involving the phenomenon have just gone through the roof in that 70-year period.
We're going to take a little break, Free Dreamlanders, and when we get back, we're going to be asking Robert and Bob for the why of this. Why do they think this is happening this way? Are we being quarantined, rescued, or what is going on here? Who, and also, who is it? We'll be right back.
The new unknown country is here, and it has so much to offer. Our huge archive of Dreamland, plus the full run of William Henry's revelations, Anne Streber's mysterious powers and her incredible contactee interviews, Whitley's Communion, Secret School, Transformation, and Majestic ebooks, his powerful meditations, and so much more. Plus every week, the full subscriber versions of Whitley's Dreamland, Mike Clellan's The Unseen, and monthly, Jeremy Vaney's The Experience. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account. Plus, a live chat every week on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific, and so much more. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. Keep this incredible site going and have a great time doing it.
UnknownCountry.com subscribers have access to a vast treasury of information. Listen to what Dr. Robert Schock said. He's an expert on the past, and for that reason, he also knows a great deal about the future.
We are re-entering, as you say, a debris field, and when you have a debris field like this, it enters the solar system, it energizes the solar system as you have things going into the sun, even clouds of dust particles, for instance, it will energize the sun, it will destabilize the sun. This is what we saw at the end of the last ice age in approximate terms, about 13,000 years ago.
You know, I'm updating this right now. This is the 19th of September, 2019, because this is happening. These asteroids and meteors are passing Earth close passbys all the time now. I'd say it's inevitable that this is going to happen. Robert Schock is right. We're going to get him back on Dreamland soon. And, you know, you will not find anyone else anywhere on the Internet, any other podcast, doing this kind of research in this way with experts like Robert Schock. So subscribe today. Guess what? That's what you ought to do. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Do it now.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
We're talking to Robert Hastings and Dr. Bob Jacobs, Confession, Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed. Two nuts and bolts UFO investigators, extremely well respected in this community for the reason that they do top drawer work. And yet here they are saying that they have had many close encounters. And we haven't gotten into the close encounters yet. We'll do that later on. But right now, I'd like to go back to this issue of why this would have ramped up when we appear to be moving toward a situation where we could destroy ourselves. And I know you guys can't answer the question. No one can. But you must have had thoughts about that. So, Bob, why don't you start out and give us some idea of why you think this may be.
When I wrote my first article about the Big Sur encounter, I included in it a thought, because I tried to piece together in my mind, why did I see that? Why did that happen? Why was it presented to me? And why was it presented to us as a species? Why did that thing come into the frame and shoot down one of our dummy nuclear warheads? I wrote my article, I think that we got a shot across the bow. I think they may have been simply showing us, hey, look, you guys want to fool around with nuclear weapons. You really shouldn't do that. And here's what can happen if you continue. We'll just destroy them. It was a simple explanation. I'm not sure that it's the right explanation, but it seemed to me that that's what we were being shown. Stop this business or we'll stop it for you. In my experiences over the past several years, in fact, I've been shown by whatever you want to call them, the entities that contact me and come to me, I've been shown a series of events. I'm usually taken to a desert location, orangish-colored rock and sandy bottoms and so forth, and I'm shown things. And one of the things I've been shown consistently is a way of making power sources. Now, I'm not a physicist. I wish I were. I'm not an electronic engineer. I wish I were, because I'm seeing these things, and I'm inherently shown what they do. When you put these things together, they perform, they manufacture this power source, which I've been shown on board. Here we go. Sounds weird. On board a craft. I saw the power source working.
Don't worry. You're talking to a lot of people who've been on board crafts on this show, including me. So go right ahead.
Then you realize how difficult this has been for me, and I think for Robert also, to come out with and go, yes, this has happened. It's happened to us. Anyhow, recently, I'm certain that you're aware of the political situation throughout the world right now. We live in a very perilous moment, as we continue living in perilous moment after perilous moment. And the problem is that we now have terrorists who don't give a hoot about ones that are blowing themselves up with atomic weapons if they get hold of them. I was shown Thursday of last week. I was taken to a place where it was like the desert places I usually go to, except, and by the way, I never see the entities, the creatures, they're always right behind me. And they talk to me through what must be telepathy, because I never hear voices, but I hear in my head what I'm being shown. I walked out in this awful, terrible place where it used to be a city or a village or some sort of civilization, and it was blackened rubble. And I was walked through it, and in the back of my head I was told, this could happen to you. Now, what do I think they're doing? I'm just doing it. I think that I'm sure there are others who might believe also that maybe they planted us here, that maybe they are us, that I don't know who they are or where they come from. There's a recent experimental idea that, well, perhaps they're us in the future and they're coming back in time machines. I don't know. I believe in certainly that there are a lot of possibilities. I'm confident through quantum mechanics and physics that there are multiverses, that we're not the only universe in the world.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely not. Having been there and done that also, I can assure you. There's a parallel universe right here all around us. And
absolutely true. I believe that, Whitley. You know, I think I've experienced that phenomenon. Anyhow, why are they here? Why are they? I think they would like us to not destroy ourselves.
I do.
People have asked me, for example, at a conference, I was asked, "Well, do they mean us harm?" And my response has always been, "Well, if they meant us harm, they would have wiped us out by now." I don't think, of course, there are more than one of them. I'm sure you agree to that. But I think the main body of the things we're experiencing are not harmful. I think they're trying to straighten us out. I have a theory. We can't get wise because we don't live long enough. Our species is, you know, at 100 years maximum, we're gone. I think if humanity could find a way to just live for, I don't know, 400-500 years, that we would get wise. We would get beyond religion. We would get beyond politics. We would get beyond hating somebody because they drive a better car than I do. They would get beyond all that petty nonsense that great philosophers come to and great religious leaders come to. And we would all be able to rise into this new age of wisdom.
Well, if there is going to be a new age, I mean, we may not survive here. It's very clear. And if you read history, which I am obsessed with personally, you find very quickly that weather plays a huge role in human affairs, and in particular in warfare. That changes in climate cause wars, and we are sitting in a situation now where there are great changes in climate that are going to stress all kinds of different populations all over the planet, including some very violent ones that are also nuclear armed. So you're right. I think it's a terribly, terribly dangerous time. But folks, what's not dangerous, Free Dreamlanders, is to listen to these commercials and do what you are asked to do. I want to say do what you're told, but I can't say that. And subscribe to the show as well. We'll be right back.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Robert Hastings and Dr. Bob Jacobs about their new book, Confession, Our Hidden Alien Encounters Revealed. We're going to begin to get into those a little bit more deeply in a few minutes. But we've been talking about, to Bob, about an experience very recently, apparently just a week ago, that, and this is recorded on the 27th of January, 2020. It's hard to say 2020. I almost said 2019. In any case, can anyone even believe these dates? I mean, this is the future. We're way past 2001. Pan Am's out of business. No one's near the moon. Whoa. No one's mining Jupiter. What happened to us? And, you know, I have to ask the question, have we been kind of sequestered here? Are we kind of trapped? Robert, what is your take on the motive behind this, incursion, as it were, into the human world?
I believe that whoever these entities are, they have been watching us for a long time. They are aware that in the last half century, a little bit more, we have developed weapons that could end human civilization, at least for a very, very long time. And potentially through the radioactive debris that would be pervasive, at least in the Northern Hemisphere from all the nuclear detonations, could drastically affect human heredity for long-term, eras. The radioactive poisoning of the environment is well known around nuclear waste sites. Can you imagine half the planet, the Northern Hemisphere, that would be most likely to engage in nuclear warfare, what sort of radioactive wasteland it might be after the fact? So in my view, yes, I agree with Bob when he said, I think that the Big Sur incident was a question of them firing a shot across the bow of our nuclear silliness ship, is the entire quote that he's made in the past. And I tend to agree with that. I think they're clearly pointing a finger at us, wagging a finger and saying, you are playing with fire, knock it off. And we now know, for example, my work has been primarily concentrated on UFO activity at American nuclear weapons facilities. But in 1993, television journalist George Knapp went to the former Soviet Union, now Russian, and interviewed a number of former Soviet military personnel. And one of those individuals actually provided him with documents that were technically still classified that he smuggled out, in effect. I don't know that George likes that word to be used, but he took these still classified documents out of Russia, some of which referred to UFO activity at Soviet nuclear missile sites, including one incident in Soviet Ukraine in October of 1982, where as a large disc-shaped craft hovered over a missile base, the missiles actually went into countdown mode and were preparing to launch for apparently 15 seconds while the missile launch crews were just, tearing their hair out. This would have been World War III had those missiles launched. And then everything returned to normal. They checked the equipment. They found no anomalies in the equipment. I have actually interviewed U.S. military personnel, Air Force officers, who described the exact same type of encounter at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, where missiles did not go down, go offline, malfunction, but actually temporarily went into countdown mode and were preparing to launch. These officers actually had to flip what was called an inhibit switch to disrupt these launches. So whoever are flying these craft, I think they're either shutting down the missiles or temporarily activating the missiles just to scare the hell out of us, just to let us know how seriously what we're doing can drastically, perhaps forever, impact the human race and our civilization if we're allowed to continue to operate these weapons and, God forbid, actually use them at some point.
Robert, let me ask you this first, and then I'd like Bob to answer the question as well. Why do you think they care? And I want to contextualize this first. Bud, as you know, Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs, too, have a very negative vision of this whole thing. The abductions are awful, and I lived this. I know Bud used to say that Whitley is, you know, too airy-fairy and spiritual, but what he was doing, and maybe to an extent purposely, was ignoring the dark side of my experience, which obviously Ann and I could not ignore because it was happening to us. It has a very dark side to it. It can be really rough. So why would they want us? It seems like they don't like us very much. So why would they want us to continue to live? Why would they be trying to warn us about survival? Because it's not just nuclear weapons. It's the environment, too. I mean, there are very few close encounter witnesses who are not strong environmentalists because of what they've learned, like me. I mean, you know, I've learned this from them from the beginning. So what are your thoughts there? They seem to want us to survive, but they're really rough on us.
If one looks at the abduction literature, a fair amount of it, you'll see a diversity of aliens being described, a diversity of morphologies, physical appearances. Some are 7 feet tall, some are 3 feet tall, some appear human-like, others appear like insects. So in my view, there's a strong suggestion that we have more than one race here visiting us, interacting with us, and therefore one would think that would imply a diversity of agendas, at least potentially. So some might be here for one reason and another group here for another reason. Clearly, based on my research, I can say that at least one of those races is very interested in humankind's nuclear weapons and has even tampered with them on a semi-frequent basis, presumably to send a point either that they have the ability to interfere with those systems or maybe just to sort of wake us up and say, look, you know, this is suicidal behavior. Sooner or later, these things will be used. Then you're in really deep. So I think that's part of what's going on. As far as the individual abduction experiences being traumatic for us humans, certainly in my case and many other people have described trauma involved with these interactions, I usually use the analogy that we utilize laboratory animals for a diversity of reasons that we describe as necessary, testing of one thing or another. And we may not need to scare the crap out of the animals while we're handling them and doing things to them in the laboratory, but you can imagine that they're terrified, whether they're mice or chimpanzees. They're traumatized by what we do to them in these laboratory settings. I think, as an analogy, these entities probably don't mean to be cruel to us when they're interacting with us aboard their craft or wherever they take us. But it's just part of the program. They're going to do what they want to do, and how we react to all of that is really of no interest to them. You know, they're just going to keep doing what they need to do for that particular interaction until it's done, and then they'll let us go. And, you know, the consequence, of course, is that most people who are abductees or aware that this is going on have this underlying trauma, whether subliminal or not, in their lives that relates to these experiences. You know, I think, you know, this business about the hybrid that people say, they took sperm from me, they took ova from me, they told me at a later date that they're creating a hybrid race. And people like Dr. David Jacobs and maybe Bud Hopkins thought that this was a terrible development, ominous, and meant that these entities would take over humankind at some point. An alternate scenario might be that there is an ongoing process of elevating the human race genetically, that they've probably been doing this for thousands of years, and what we now in the 21st century are as a flesh and blood creature is not what we were 20,000 years ago. And perhaps if these hybrid programs have merit, the abductees have described, perhaps 1,000 or 10,000 years from now, we will be an evolved creature. We will have telepathy. We will have a sense of compassion for other humans. We will have a strong sense of our integral place in our environment and not screw up the earth left and right like we're doing at this point in our history. But we'll understand that we need to protect our fragile spaceship in space and actually work with the rest of nature to create a better planet. So I'm not as pessimistic, or I don't think the descriptions of human hybrids and so on is as dire as some people would suggest.
Okay, Bob, how do you react to the same question, if I may ask?
Well, there is a school of thought that at least one or two of these different races may be our parents. They may be the God that we hope for all the time, that created us and put us here, and therefore they are interested in it. That's one way to look at it. I agree with Robert. I'm certain that there are more than one species of these entities throughout the universe. There are trillions of galaxies, as we now know from the Hubble telescope and other wonderful things looking into deep space. I think that most of the experiences, certainly that I've had a couple of scary moments, like the one I had last Thursday, when I went, oh my God, what am I supposed to do with this information? You just show me something. Is it a warning? Is it something that happened? Is it something that could happen? I don't know what that was all about, but it certainly rattled my brain for a few days, and I still get queasy about what I was seeing. It was horrifying. For the most part, I've had interesting experiences that show me something that I wish I were smarter so I could understand, like the power sources and like their time-space warping to travel, which they showed me that that's what they do. And they even let me do it for a brief period of time. And I know how crazy this sounds, but well, I suppose you know better than I do how crazy it sounds.
Well, that's okay. But you're in the right place. Believe me. This is Crazy House, but the truth, and all my listeners know it perfectly well, this is actually the center of human sanity, because this is a place where we are looking at the world as it really is, not as we would prefer it to be or like we want to make ourselves believe. This is the truth, the naked truth. That's what this is about, the experience of being human. And I want to ask you now, Bob, the question is that how human is this? In other words, are we dealing with something that is so integral to human life that we might as well be kind of a different part of the same species? In other words, there's a blurred line between the human alien level of this. Yes, they are from different parts of the universe, but they have been here so long. Do we even have the right to call them aliens?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that as an exact question, but you're quite right. They've been here as long as we have, probably before we came along, Homo sapiens sapiens. As far as I'm concerned, from the research I've done and the stories I'm told, they've been here all along, ever since we've been here, because we have cave paintings about them. We have stories about them around campfires in various populations around the world. Of course, them have been here certainly as long as we have. And are they influencing us? Are they always trying to change us, trying to make us better, make us different? Well, we certainly have evolved, haven't we? Since we came along some few hundred thousand years ago, million years ago, depending on what archaeological source you you judge humans coming along. I'm encouraged. I'm optimistic, I think, over what's happening to me. And I've had experiences that didn't happen in bed. You know, for example, I wrote this in the book. I used to have a cabin down in Arkansas on the Buffalo River, and I used to drive over to a little town called Mountain View, where they have great, wonderful mountain music, the folk music capital of the world. And I was at a concert one night that got out around 9 o'clock, and driving back from Mountain View to my cabin in near Marshall, Arkansas, the road drives along a ridge, a mountain ridge, until it comes down to the town of Leslie, where it cascades down out of the ridge. Well, imagine driving on a mountain ridge. If you look in your rearview mirror, you see a ribbon of highway twisting down and up and around all the way back to Mountain View. I was driving along with my wife, and we were discussing the concert and have a wonderful time we had, and then she sort of drifted off to sleep. I looked in the rearview mirror way, way back there. I saw what I assumed were headlights following me on that same road. Well, I kept referring back to my rearview mirror, and these lights got closer much faster than they should have. If anybody was driving along that road, they couldn't have been driving 100 miles an hour, but that's how fast this thing seemed to be going. And it caught up to me well before I got down into the down grade into Leslie. This thing came up behind me, and it was elevated above me. It was extremely wide. It certainly wasn't a truck or a car or a Volkswagen driving along the road behind me. It was in the air just behind me. And there were several large white lights, and some that were a bit greenish, and this thing followed me down the road. We went around the curves, and I ended up down in the little town of Leslie, and the road ends at a stop sign. And then it turned, you have to turn onto Main Street in Leslie to get out to get over the Highway 65 to go back up home to Marshall. I got down to the stop sign. The lights were clearly behind me, elevated. I turned right onto Main Street and stopped to see what this thing was. Sat there for several seconds, and nothing came out. I got out of my car and walked back and looked up the road. There was nothing there. Now, Robert asked me if I had had any lost time, and the best I can come up with is the drive from Mountain View to my cabin was usually about 55 minutes to an hour. It had taken me well over an hour and a half to get to my cabin. Was that an encounter? Was that something following me? Well, I sure think it was.
Yes.
And because it wasn't anything like I'd ever had experienced before, and I felt like there was a presence around me while this thing was around my car.
It's one of the most riveting descriptions in this whole book, because the idea of going down that road with that thing seemingly just pushing and pressing you to go faster down that curvy, dark road is terrifying. And then
it was scary because that's a very dangerous two-lane road.
Of course, and it was taking a risk with your life, because you could have gone off that road very easily. Now we're coming to the end of the free part of the show, and that means that free Dreamlanders, imagine what you're not going to be able to hear, and if you can't imagine that, then subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab and get started. Join this community. As the years pass, it's becoming a more and more important community. When I started this website and Annie and I started this show over 20 years ago, this was Ridicule Central. Now, on this website, I can assure you, and everybody is treated the same way here, you're all anonymous if you join the website. Nobody's going to know that it's you. But there are many people on this website who have extraordinary places in the world and lead extraordinary lives in contact. So, and I urge you to do this. Now, I also urge you to get into this by reading Confession, Our Alien Encounters Revealed. This is very serious stuff. Ed Bell Bruno and Deep Prasad told their stories, but they don't have books. They told their stories as leading scientists who are having experiences. Now here is a book by leading UFO investigators who have had extraordinary experiences. And I have to tell you that it is filled on almost every page with serious insight into the experience, what it means, and where it's going. Subscribers, we're going to keep on keeping on. Free Dreamlanders, goodbye for now. Come back next week and listen to the whole show.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.